Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for February 4th, 2011. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, it's the 10th anniversary of the completion of the Human Genome Project. We'll hear also about the latest genome sequenced, that of the first crustacean, and finally, directing the evolution of a protein container. Researchers are copying how nature compartmentalizes.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Has it been 10 years already?
Richard Gibbs is director of the Human Genome Sequencing Center at Baylor College of Medicine and reflects in this week's issue on the 10th anniversary of the completion of the Human Genome Project.
There have been cycles. In the beginning, genomics was a sub-branch of genetics. Then we went off to do the Human Genome Project. When we produced the first human genome sequence, we were all amazed. We saw that the gene count was lower than expected, and we saw the size of each of the individual classes of gene products. And all of that, even though we really had no clue about the functional roles of at least a half of the genes. And so many of us expected wide enthusiasm to follow for more sequencing, more biology, and more discovery. Instead, the community was slow to warm up to genomics and the concept of routinely analyzing whole genomes to advance knowledge. Sequencing the first human genome really changed the way all biologists work. But 10 years ago, it did not change many opinions about big science and having to rely on such large projects. Now, after several years of model organism genomes and deep surveys of genetic variation and a recent burst of technical development, appetites are increasing for DNA sequencing and further big science, just like the Human Genome Project. Personal diploid genome sequences showed us the way forward in studies of human biology. But the most exciting data now are from solving the genetics of individual Mendelian disorders, the rare single gene disorders where the phenotype-genotype relationships really make sense. The new methods and the willingness to tackle human Mendelian genetics with full attention to all of the genetic modifiers and the heterogeneity will enable the realization of the impact of genomics in genetics. Genomics became a discipline that was separated from genetics more than 20 years ago, but now the two are finally coming back together. I am Richard Gibbs.
Richard Gibbs is director of the Human Genome Sequencing Center at Baylor College of Medicine. In this week's Science, and throughout the month of February, you can read vignettes by scientists, artists, politicians, and others reflecting on the 10th anniversary of the completion of the Human Genome Project.
We took a look at what's happened in medicine since the sequencing of the human genome roughly 10 years ago to see how much it actually penetrated clinical practice.
Science's Elliot Marshall writes in this week's News Focus on the promised future of genomic medicine, still unrealized.
And discovered that progress has been slow and wanted to find out why that was so. And the reason is a mixture of answers.
What was the promise, the original promise of the Human Genome Project?
The implicit promise was that it was going to change medicine. That's why the National Institutes of Health invested several billion dollars in it. It was going to make it easier to identify diseases and treat them, and that it would, in essence, revolutionize medicine.
Did that promise of the Human Genome Project have a particular timeline?
There were some statements certainly made by the director of the Human Genome Research Institute, Francis Collins, who said that within 10 years, certain things would happen. Genetic tests would be available. And then he made a forecast out to 20 years later about a number of things that would be happening in medicine. Being a clever person, he didn't get extremely specific about it. But they involved changing the way we treat diseases, identify diseases and treat them. But the broad promise is that it was going to change medicine.
At this point, then, what, if any, established clinical applications are there that are based on this increased understanding of the human genome?
Well, there are many that are developing. In this article, I decided to look at primary medicine, which is the medical world that you encounter when you come in to see the doctor. So that would give an idea of how broadly the new technology has spread. And there, it's not gotten very far.
With all the investment, both in the original Human Genome Project and the spending done since then by governments, institutions, private enterprise, Are we about to see then a big increase in genetics, genomics-based medicine?
We're about to see a real explosion in genetic tests that will be offered to patients and for people who may be taking medicine to determine whether they are going to metabolize medicine properly. We're about to see a lot of genetic testing, genetic sequencing of individuals. The purpose of it is not yet clear entirely. And we're about to see a lot of genetic analysis of tumors, possibly to shape the course of treatment.
So it's not as if doctors aren't implementing genetics-based treatments or aren't aware of genetics-based treatments. It's just that there really aren't any treatments at this point. It's just testing.
There's more research than there is actual practice of medicine in genomic medicine. But there is much more going on, I would say, in certain specialized areas, one of them being cancer, another being pharmacogenomics, which is the tailoring of drug treatment to the individual. There is some tension in the genetics community between those who are, in a sense, advocates of genomic medicine and want to see it advanced as quickly as possible, and others who are more clinically minded and have other, I guess, other things than genetics on their mind, who say that it's a mistake to single out genetics-based technologies for particular emphasis, and that they will develop in time on their own as they prove worth doing. I've run into that, and you know, there's some doctors who think we should be pleased that we've come as far as we have.
How is the information gained from a genetic test different than what we might be accustomed to?
It's much more complicated than dealing with some tests that primary care physicians are used to using. There are many different steps of decision-making that involve ethical decisions, privacy, whether you share information with relatives, whose responsibility is it to share the information, what do you tell the relatives, and who pays for it. So in all those ways, it's more complicated than blood tests that we're accustomed to. And there was a survey taken last year of members of the American Medical Association to see how they felt about genomic medicine, and surprisingly, 90% or more thought that genetic tests were worth doing in connection with prescribing medicines because you could determine what your patient's metabolism, how it would respond to the specific drug. On the other hand, only 10% thought that they had the confidence that they had the knowledge they needed to make decisions about genetic testing and using the information in prescribing drugs. So that was a kind of a stark contrast between what people expect and hope for genomic medicine and what they feel they know about it and are competent to use.
Are there instances where researchers or doctors are saying, you know, these genetic tests aren't there yet, or don't say anything that would really change treatment, so just avoid them for now?
There have been a number of reviews that are geared towards giving public health recommendations that have come out with an unsatisfactory answer, which is there's insufficient evidence to tell whether these genetic technologies will or will not improve the health of the patient. So that's not a very encouraging answer. But the people who are developing these technologies say that you just need to wait a little bit and they will be there. If you were to ask me where will genomic medicine make itself important, earliest stage, I think it will be in dealing with prescription drugs. Because here we know that there are people who are at risk because they metabolize drugs differently or they have these individual responses to drugs that are determined by their genetics. And we know also that we have the tools to determine which people these are. So the patients themselves will begin to ask of doctors, why aren't you checking to see whether I am uniquely vulnerable to this drug or getting me the right drug? And I think that pressure from the patients, the consumers, is going to drive the technology forward. Doctors will have to do it. They'll have to be testing for genetic anomalies and mutations that may put their patients at risk or give them a different response to the drug than the so-called norm. So that will happen pretty quickly, I think, within the next few years.
Beyond more time, what will it take for the biomedical community to fulfill the promise of the Human Genome Project? More research, better cooperation with doctors, relaxed privacy regulations on genetic information, better data management, better opportunities for capital investment, all of these and more? What?
I think all of these things. The leaders in the genetic education that I spoke to identified two things right at the top of the list. One of them was just to do more clinical testing that will demonstrate the clinical utility of these new technologies, that is, find cases where patients clearly benefit from early genetic diagnostics and intervention. The second thing was to get the information that already exists into the hands of doctors at the point of care, particularly in sort of quick, compact, concise testing and information providing, perhaps with the use of digital technology, internet, and new search and knowledge sharing technologies. So those are the two top items. And then the third one, of course, is educating doctors in genetics broadly, and a number of medical schools are already rewriting their curricula to make that possible. Of course, there's another issue that affects everybody who's trying to make genomic medicine work, is the fragmented nature of our healthcare system. And some of these technologies, some tests, particularly the methods of testing for metabolic differences in reaction to drugs, work best when they're done in a public health manner, which means that you sort of need to embrace the entire population, identify the risk within the population and target that. That can best be done in a sort of a comprehensive care approach, which we don't really have in the United States.
What about elsewhere, internationally, where rules or regulations or funding is different?
I think there's a much better chance of doing this rationally in England, for example, where there is a national health program and sort of centralized ability to review records and deal with risks in a balanced way. It's beginning to happen in this country, but it is still fragmented by certain diseases and how laws are written to cover some and not others. I think in other countries, it's just simply probably the cost of the technology and the pace of development. It's very fast here. In the United States, we have lots of investment in technology, less investment in making it available broadly to the public. I think you can safely say that without predicting whether it will be 10, 15, or 20 years when genomic medicine arrives and is part of the primary healthcare system, I think we can say that it's coming. It's coming in stages. And I think if you were to go to sleep now, wake up 20 years from now and look around, it would be a very different world and genomic medicine would be everywhere you look. But there's still a great deal to do, both in research and in applying the research. One of the more frustrating areas in genomic medicine has been a lack of progress in developing tools for diagnosing and treating common diseases, say, for example, diabetes. We've found that many, many genes contribute to these common diseases. It's not so far been possible to isolate critical few that may be the main actors, and that makes it difficult to develop applications or diagnosis for treatment. So this is an area that's going to continue to be getting a lot of attention in research, but not yet ready for, as they say, prime time in medicine.
Elliot Marshall, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Science's Elliot Marshall writes in this week's News Focus on the promised future of genomic medicine, still unrealized.
Everything that lives, has ever lived, or will ever live on planet Earth has just four nucleotides: adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine.
Xavier Cortada is an artist whose studio is in Miami Beach, Florida. He reflects in this week's issue on the 10th anniversary of the completion of the Human Genome Project.
And mapping how these building blocks arrange to create a human being helps us better understand how interconnected we are to one another and the natural world. As an artist, I recently created portraits of life's four building blocks. It felt as if I were painting a relative, except that I was bringing molecular formulas, not ancestors, to life. Within each large, colorful canvas, I painted imaginary subatomic landscapes with floating base pairs, the purines in blue and red, the pyrimidines in green and yellow. Then, at the exhibit's opening, I invited 400 museum visitors to help synthesize a DNA molecule. Through art, I wanted the visitors to explore the sequence of events that make up life on the planet, from the molecular to the monumental. So, participants randomly selected postcards depicting one of the four nucleotide paintings and attached them along the exhibit's wall. Through their participation, they generated a 400 nucleotide sequence. T, C, T, A. Later, we synthesized the DNA strand in Kalei Mathi's laboratory at the College of Medicine, Florida International University. We propagated it within bacteria in a petri dish and analyzed it against other existing sequences. Our randomly generated sequence could have belonged to any or none of Earth's species. But instead, it resembled the portion of human chromosome 3 that encodes proteins directing the navigation of axons and our neurons during development. More of us need to realize that we came about in the same way that all other life did. We share the same biology. May we use the knowledge we develop to act as best we can to sustain life for all species sharing this planet. I'm Xavier Cortada.
Xavier Cortada is an artist whose studio is in Miami Beach, Florida. In this week's Science and throughout the month of February, you can read vignettes by artists, scientists, politicians, and others reflecting on the 10th anniversary of the completion of the Human Genome Project. Find them and more at sciencemag.org/extra/genome anniversary.
The Human Genome Project pretty much motivated our aspirations to do the same for Daphnia.
John Colburn is lead author of a paper in this week's Science describing the draft sequence of Daphnia pulex, or water flea, first described in 1665 by Robert Hooke, regarded as the first person to describe observations made through a microscope. Michael Frender is also an author of this week's paper on the water flea.
Because of this depth of ecological research and the body of understanding that we had, it's really a prime example of an organism that we can place our understanding of the genome in the context of its biology.
The other thing about the water flea, which is what Frender and Colburn say helped convince the U.S. Department of Energy to help fund the sequencing project, is that for a long time, the water flea has been used as a model organism for toxicology studies, trying to understand how organisms respond to chemicals and contaminants in their environment. I spoke with Colburn from his office at Indiana University and Frender from his office at the University of Notre Dame. Their team's paper, The Eco-Responsive Genome of Daphnia pulex. Here's John Colburn.
This paper is the work of a multidisciplinary research team distributed around the world who's ventured to study for the first time the genome sequence of a crustacean. And the crustacean that was chosen is commonly known as the water flea, scientifically known as Daphnia pulex. And the reason why we were so intrigued with this organism to begin with is because it's attracted the attention of biologists for already a very long time, beginning in the 1600s, where it was first described as the water blob. And why the attention is simply because naturalists at the time were taking advantage of the newly invented microscope and was becoming intrigued by the constituents of lakes and ponds. And in this case, this organism holds a very, very key role to play in freshwater ecosystems in that it is the primary grazer of algae and bacteria, and it's also the primary forage for small fish. Most intriguingly is that the investigators had noted that it has some phenomenal biology, including the ability to reproduce without the intervention of males, something that Darwin had reported to the Royal Society a long time ago. And so given its importance in the water system, given its interesting biology, we ventured to ask the question, can that biology be somehow recorded in the genome of organisms such as the water flea? What we've discovered is that indeed, given the phenomenal biology of the organism, the genome also has some phenomenal attributes that may be associated with explaining why Daphnia is the way it is.
Thank you, John. Mike, I imagine there are lots of species of water fleas. Why this particular one?
Well, that's a very interesting question. In the early discussions that we had with the Daphnia Genome Consortium, in the time we were planning this project, there was a great deal of discussion about that exact topic, which of the species of Daphnia would be the most likely candidates for this kind of an effort. And the species that we chose, Daphnia pulex, really won that discussion because of its ubiquitous presence across North American freshwaters. It's one of our most common and most distributed species in this region. That's not necessarily the case in other areas. For example, Daphnia magna, a different species, is extremely common in Europe and is worked on by European researchers quite a bit. The other reason that Daphnia pulex was chosen, though, is because we have a very nice understanding of its role in ecosystems and freshwater lakes. We understand a lot about its role as a grazer of algae. We understand its role as a prey species for vertebrate predators like fish. And so there's a long history of studying the ecology of Daphnia pulex in North American freshwaters that really gave us the background that we needed to place our understanding of the genome sequence into an ecological context.
So, John, what coverage did you and your team achieve? I'm assuming this is a draft genome?
It is indeed a draft genome. The sequencing was done by the Department of Energy's Joint Genome Institute in California, and it was done through the old-fashioned Sanger method, which included over 1.7 million short reads that has a coverage of roughly 8 or 9 times coverage of a 200 megabase genome.
And how many genes did you and your team find among that rather small genome length?
One of the most fascinating discoveries is the fact that despite its small size, Daphnia contains over 31,000 genes, which came to a surprise simply because humans, for instance, have roughly around 23,000 genes, the fruit fly around 16,000 genes. And so what we're seeing here is almost twice as many genes in this first crustacean sequence compared to other arthropods, and arthropods would include insects and other crustacea.
Mike, how do you know that gene count isn't inflated?
Well, we brought a number of lines of evidence to bear in trying to understand how many genes and which of these genes are actually expressed in Daphnia. And so these lines of evidence include computational predictions of gene models and then validation using proteomics approaches to look for protein products from those genes. We use two different types of microarrays, an expression array and a tiling array that covers the whole genome to look for expression patterns. We also look to see which of the genes were interrupted by stop codons, for example, that would suggest that they're pseudogenes. And when we take all those lines of evidence together, then we have a set of genes that we're quite confident are actually functioning genes.
So when you look at this genome, what accounts for that high number of genes? John?
When looking at the number of genes, one possibility would be that sometime during the evolutionary history of Daphnia, that it had undergone a whole genome duplication event. And that could explain the doubling of the number of genes compared to insects. But that's not the case in Daphnia. What we find is that when you're looking at the distribution of these duplicated genes, they're found in what we call tandemly duplicated gene clusters, or long strings of genes that are arranged head to tail, sometimes numbering roughly 60 copies in a local region. What it's suggesting is that certain genes have a greater propensity of being found in multiple copies than others. And then the next question that we had to ask was why certain gene families seem to be amplified, whereas others are not.
What in particular would benefit the water flea in some way from having so many duplicates of particular genes? Mike?
So one idea is that if you have more genes, that allows you to make more of the gene product. And so if there's an advantage, what we call a dosage advantage, then that's one reason why genes may be preserved in multiple copies. The organism can respond more readily to whatever stimulus is eliciting the response of that gene by making more product faster. That's one possibility. The other possibility that we've begun to explore and comes out of the results of this paper is that these duplicated genes may be involved in gene-gene interactions. And so that what you're seeing is an actual amplification of genes within enzyme networks in metabolic pathways, for example. And when we look at the functional data that we generated, the microarray data, the very interesting result is that we're seeing different sets of these duplicate genes responding to different environmental conditions. And so it seems like this is part of the story as well, is that Daphnia is using the excess number of duplicate genes to respond in a very precise way to environmental stimulus.
So you're challenging the Daphnia with various environmental scenarios?
In the work that went into the paper, we challenged them with a set of 8 different environmental conditions that ranged from exposures to metals or other toxicants in the environment. We included some biological stressors like chemical cues from predators, which are the typical cue that would cause a Daphnia to grow a big helmet or a big tail spine. We also compared males and females, so we did a whole variety of different abiotic and biotic stressors to then look at the transcriptional patterns and look across these sets of duplicated genes.
So actual morphological changes as a response to these environmental stressors.
It's an interesting concept.
John?
Traits that are ecologically relevant, such as these exaggerated helmet formations when they are threatened by predators, or, for instance, the very high level of accumulation of hemoglobin when they're found in anoxic situations. one could say that there is a hardwired genetic component to that, segregating among natural populations. But in Daphnia's case, it shows a phenomenal level of what is called phenotypic plasticity, this ability to change form, change behaviors, change physiological states that are linked to cues that they obtain from the environment. It's one of the fundamental interesting components of Daphnia that includes, for instance, its reproductive cycle, where in fact when Daphnia reproduce, they reproduce by a system called cyclical parthenogenesis, where when under benign conditions, the females would simply produce genetically identical daughters. But when cued or stressed by the environment, they will switch from producing genetically identical daughters to genetically identical sons. And through the matings of the female and males within the population, they will produce a different type of egg called a resting egg that could then withstand desiccation, freezing, other environmental hardships for decades, and then reemerge in subsequent growing seasons from these accumulated propagule egg banks. All these responses to environmental cues have to have some sort of genetic component to it. It's difficult to trace what those genes are, but one hypothesis would be that Daphnia's phenotypic plasticity is linked to the propensity or the propagation of these gene families that tend to be very specific in the types and times that they are expressed within their ecological ranges.
You said this was the first crustacean that's been sequenced.
That's right.
So in comparing your team's sequence of the water flea genome to other sequences of other animal species, how much of the genome is new, that is, doesn't match up with other genomes previously studied?
So one of the motivations for sequencing the Daphnia genome was
Mike?
Because it fits a very interesting phylogenetic position, being a sister group to all of the insect genomes that have been sequenced, like the fruit flies and now aphids, etc. When we compare the Daphnia genome and we look at the similarity of genes between Daphnia and between the other arthropod genomes that have been sequenced, we see that about a third of the genes have no homology or similarity to the genes in these other organisms. So a very large fraction of those 30,000 genes are relatively unknown. They don't match any other genome sequences. They're new genes in that sense that we're just now discovering.
And so the thought is that this is what allows this particular genus to morphologically change. What Darwin was so interested in, you found now at least targets to look at within the genome to try and explain these changes.
So,
Mike?
I think part of the reason that these genes have not been described is because this is, in fact, the first crustacean that we've looked at. And crustaceans are quite divergent from other arthropods. It's probably a 400 million years or so that separate those groups. So we're looking at genes that have evolved since the division of those groups evolutionarily. What we don't know is what those genes are doing. And this is actually the really exciting part of the research that will follow, is trying to understand the function of those genes. To what extent are they involved in these direct environmental responses? How are they similar to the function of genes in other insects? This is the exact quest that the Drosophila biologists and biologists working in other model organisms have been embarked on for the past 30 or 40 or more years, is to try to understand the function of genes. Now we have a big set of these that we really don't know anything about. And so it's tremendously exciting to be able to look at the function of these genes in response to the environment that this organism lives in. And we do think that there's a direct connection between the roles these genes play and the environmental stressors that have been part of the evolutionary and ecological history of Daphnia.
John Colburn and Mike Frender, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Colburn of Indiana University and Mike Frender of the University of Notre Dame are the first two authors of a paper in this week's Science on the eco-responsive genome of the water flea, Daphnia pulex. In a eukaryotic cell, like those of plants and animals, what separates the genome from the rest of the cell is the nuclear envelope, or membrane. Viral genomes are protected from their environment by what's called a capsid, built from proteins. Indeed, As Donald Hilvert and colleagues write in their paper in this week's Science, compartmentalization is a hallmark of life on Earth, including transport of minerals, delivering nucleic acids, and regulating enzyme catalysis. Hilvert and his team engineered artificial capsids inside bacteria that spontaneously capture a toxic protease or enzyme also produced within the bacteria. Then they directed the evolution of the bacteria, selecting for an improved ability of the capsid to capture the toxic enzyme. The researchers report that their proof-of-principle strategy could be used for several biotechnology applications in living cells. I spoke with Hilvert from his office at ETH Zurich.
We have taken a natural system that forms hollow spheres like viruses, and we've engineered it to encapsulate or cage foreign molecules. And we've optimized this system then through directed evolution.
And you've done this inside a living system then, because it's evolving.
That's true. So we have produced this hollow sphere inside cells. It's basically a protein and can be encoded by genetic means on a plasmid, produced inside a cell. And it will spontaneously assemble inside the cytosol of an E. coli, for example, and then encapsulate its target protein, in our case, a toxic protease that's otherwise harmful for the cell. And by encapsulating this toxic material, we can protect the cell from its ravages.
So you and your team copied what typically happens with certain viruses, engineered a shell, a capsid?
That's right.
But instead of forming around a virus's genetic material, you synthesized it inside a bacteria to form around a protease. Is that right?
That's right. The protein that we started with naturally forms protein shells, but we have engineered the interior surface so that it is very strongly negatively charged. And as a consequence, when that protein is produced inside a cell, in the presence of another molecule, the guest, which has a complementary positive charge, and in our case, we've just engineered a positively charged tail to which we attach to the guest, they co-assemble into this cage structure with the guest on the inside, surrounded by this thin protein shell that we've engineered.
So you said normally this toxic substance would be damaging to the cell, the protein sphere encapsulates it, but only when it has this tag on it.
That's right.
So it's a function of negative and positive charges attracting one another.
That's right. We use Coulombic interactions to drive the association of the host, our sphere, and the guest, the toxic protease. And so they co-assemble spontaneously inside the cell as both are being produced. And so that allows us to produce very large concentrations of the toxic material because it doesn't degrade the other components of the cytosol.
So the toxic material is injected in some way into the cell and...
No. So both the host, the sphere-like protein, it's an ensemble of 180 to 240 different subunits that form the sphere. And the toxic protease, HIV protease is what we use, are co-produced inside the cell. They're both produced from plasmids, and we can control their relative concentrations. And when they're both produced, they assemble into this inert complex. So by encasing the HIV protease within this thin protein shell, the engineered capsid protects the cell basically by placing a physical barrier between the enzyme and the potential cytoplasmic substrates.
Now, all this machinery, this spontaneous formation of this shell, the capsid around the HIV protease happening inside the bacteria, does all that give the bacteria some advantage compared to ones without any of this HIV protease and capsid forming ability?
So if you have a cell that produces the HIV protease, you have a problem because the HIV protease is toxic. Because as a protease, it can clip many, many different protein substrates in the cytosol. And so the cells are very, very sick. And basically, they have great difficulty producing even small amounts of this toxic material. But when you also produce the capsid, the engineered molecule that can encapsulate the protease, you confer a selective advantage to the host cell because basically you hide the protease inside this container, this protein container. And so it can no longer access the cytosolic proteins that it would normally serve as its substrates. And so the cell can grow. And so with the original designed capsid with the negative charges on its luminal surface, the growth advantage is small. You can accommodate low concentrations of protease, but you can't accommodate high protease concentrations because eventually the amount that's encapsulated is just a tiny fraction of the total protease. So the encapsulation is not very efficient. The caging process is not very efficient. So then that provides us a selectable marker, if you will. So we can then introduce random mutations into the capsid molecule and look for variants that make better cages that can more efficiently take up the HIV protease and hide it within this sort of mini organelle. And you can do this over multiple rounds. You can mutate and then look for variants that grow at higher protease concentrations. And you can take those variants and introduce new mutations and look for variants that grow even faster and repeat this. We did it ultimately four times until we had a new capsid molecule, still with a negative interior, that could encapsulate 5 to 10 times more HIV protease than our starting design.
So is that then this enhanced ability of a capsid to encapsulate HIV protease, is that the mechanism behind the growth advantage of these evolved cells?
That's what we believe. We looked at a number of other alternatives. One possibility would be that the production of the capsid somehow suppresses the amount of protease that you produce. So we can tell very clearly using Western blotting that as you evolve the capsid, the total amount of protease produced in the cell increases very substantially, and it parallels the increases of protease that we see encapsulated. So we believe that that is not a relevant mechanism. One of the reviewers had suggested that the production of the capsid may induce some kind of stress response that itself could increase the tolerance to the toxic protease. But we've looked at a number of different standard markers for stress responses, and we see that they're not upregulated when we produce our capsid or our protease together. So we think that the most likely explanation for our observations is that the increased encapsulation ability of our container is the reason for the selective advantage.
Can you take all this machinery outside the bacteria and replicate the results?
So that's not reported in the paper, but we have done additional experiments which suggest that we can indeed take the capsid and encapsulate other molecules in vitro as well.
And so then to the practical applications, what are they?
So I think that there are a number of possibilities. First, one can imagine trying to produce toxic proteins in cells. This is often very difficult. In this case, one can imagine producing them in a little organelle-like structure within the cell, where they could also retain their catalytic activity in principle. In this particular case, the substrates of the protease can't get to the catalyst because the substrates are too big to pass through the pores in the wall of the capsid. But you could imagine having a mini reaction chamber if the substrates were small. In fact, our starting capsid molecule itself is an enzyme, and its natural substrates have to enter into the interior of the sphere by passing through small tunnels. And so one could imagine that substrates for the encapsulated enzyme or guest molecule would also be able to pursue a similar pathway.
You said a number of possibilities. Is this a proof of principle then?
Yes, I think this is really a proof of principle. I mean, I don't think that the system as it stands right now is really practical, but it shows that one first can use evolutionary methods to optimize a nanotechnological construct, this little protein container, and you can do that very efficiently. And we would hope that one could encapsulate lots of different kinds of molecules in this way, not just HIV protease. You could also imagine that one can use the same strategy to encapsulate negatively charged molecules by painting the interior of the capsid not with negative charges, but with positive charges. So you could imagine developing a protein container for nucleic acids, a la viruses, and perhaps use this to deliver special guest molecules to the cell, if you could also equip them with an appropriate tagging mechanism.
So it sounds as if by studying these, you might also get an understanding of how nature did this in the first place.
That's what one would hope.
Don Hilbert, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Don Hilbert of ETH Zurich is senior author of a paper on directing the evolution of a protein container. If you missed our regular Science Now segment, it will be back next week. In the meantime, you can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the February 4th, 2011 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.